more big media figures fall as Matt Lauer and Garrison Keillor are both fired for inappropriate behavior. But what is the legal definition of sexual harassment? Just ahead, a closer look at our shifting culture and what the law says about how we all need to behave in the workplace. Good morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. And thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross. We're always live at 9. And make sure to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, and through our app. Just ahead, two local attorneys share their insights about all of the wave of sexual harassment scandals and the legal ramifications. What are your questions? You can get on the line right now at 549-2937. Then later, November marks National Runaway Prevention Month. We'll tell you how the city's Youth Crisis Center is working to protect children and keep them from running away from home. Then later on, travel blogger Judy Wells joins us. All of that ahead this morning. But first this hour, two more media giants fall. Fired NBC star Matt Lauer issued a statement this morning expressing remorse for his actions that led to him losing his 20-year position as anchor of NBC's Today Show. Both Lauer and longtime public radio fixture Garrison Keillor were fired yesterday from their high-profile posts after facing serious allegations of sexual misconduct. Now, Lauer is accused of sexual harassment by multiple women, including sending a sex toy to a coworker, exposing himself to a female colleague, and other lurid allegations. Lauer and Keillor are just the latest in a very long line of men to lose their jobs as women find the courage to come forward and accuse them of unacceptable behavior in the workplace. Everyone from former Hollywood mogul Harvey Weinstein to former Fox News star Bill O'Reilly and many more have lost their careers as society has this long overdue reckoning about the longstanding issue of sexual harassment and sexual assault in the workplace and in society. Now, when it comes to how harassment is defined, there can sometimes be confusion. This morning, we welcome two regular legal contributors to the show to share their expertise and take your calls. We're pleased to welcome labor and employment attorney Tad Delegal to Studio 5. Hey, Tad.
Hey, Melissa. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for having being on the show. And also with us, defense attorney Janet Johnson.
Good morning, Melissa.
Good to have you both. And here's our question to callers. What are your thoughts about this wave of firings and revelations involving high-profile figures accused of sexual harassment, sexual assault? What are your questions about how these cases are defined under the law? Give us a call, 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online, send your emails to firstcoastconnect at wjct.org. Tweets to at Melissa in Jax. And you can also weigh in on our Facebook page. Tad Delegal, let's begin with you. It seems NBC got ahead of this and fired Matt Lauer because they got wind of the fact that several media outlets were working on exposés of his behavior. And the court of when we talk about what goes on in real court, in the court of public opinion, the pendulum has shifted decisively in favor of believing women when they come forward with these allegations. Was NBC covering itself legally by letting Lauer go?
Well, I don't know all the facts, but generally with sexual harassment, from a legal liability standpoint, an employer is responsible for receiving complaints. In fact, they are responsible for having a program in place, then receiving complaints, investigating the complaints, and taking appropriate remedial action. And that doesn't mean you have to fire everybody. And I, in a lot of ways, I hope that it doesn't mean that, because frankly, I think that sometimes when you take that extreme action in every case, you're going to inhibit people from reporting. There may be some minor actions that are more appropriately dealt with retraining or some kind of lesser discipline. But because I think a lot of the women who are affected don't want to see everybody fired, but they just want to be left alone. They don't want to be harassed. And that's the important thing about it. I don't know what NBC was doing, but that is part of an employer's responsibilities.
Janet Johnson, it seems as though so many men are overnight just losing their jobs. There are some high-profile cases. But the truth is, the standard for harassment under the law is high, and very few of these cases actually ever make it to trial. Aren't most of them settled?
Yeah, you know, there's a process you have to go through the government first to launch a complaint. But, you know, the real problem is, what if you're not believed, or what if nothing happens? And then you have to work. You know, Tad talks about retraining. You know, how do you go back to work? You know, the allegations of Matt Lauer, you know, exposing himself to people. He had a button on his desk to lock the door, you know, and NBC.
Without getting up from his desk.
Right, because that would be such a hassle. But, you know, NBC apparently installed the button.
Right.
You know, so they would have known that this was going on. You know, not to be radicalized here, but I think they should all be fired, quite frankly. I mean, I think if you don't know that sending a sex toy to your coworker is wrong, and some of these things are actually criminal. I mean, these aren't just we're using sexual harassment.
Flashing is criminal. Exposing yourself is a criminal offense, isn't it?
Yes, that's criminal. Touching someone is at least a battery, if not a sexual battery in some of these cases. You know, we're calling it sexual harassment, and that's what the media has been saying. Another sexual harassment case. I mean, you know, the Roy Moore allegations, and this is, I think, something that, not to change the subject, but, you know, Matt Lauer is being held to a higher standard than people in Congress and then the United States president. And I think that's
President Trump.
Yes. To name it specific.
Let me follow up and ask you both about that. Do you think in part this wave of firings and this reckoning is due in part to the fact that there's pent-up anger that our president has faced more than a dozen allegations of sexual harassment / sexual assault, but has not really faced any repercussions for it?
I don't know. I you know, frankly, I think there's some rethinking about how we treated President Clinton. And
absolutely, there's been a revisiting of how Bill Clinton's legacy is being viewed as well, because Bill Clinton's been accused of sexual assault.
Right. I don't know with the Trump election, because I don't think many people actually voted for him thought he was actually a good person, with all the mountain of different allegations and evidence against him. They voted for him for different reasons. So that's a hard one to tell. I think it was unfortunate that, you know, that those things came up and that he stayed in the race or, you know, was elected. But I think the key thing is bringing these issues out, I think, is giving us an opportunity to have a discussion about sexual harassment in the workplace. And I want to speak about one of the things that Janet said. Obviously, the allegations against Lauer are pretty extreme, but that's not the case in every situation. There are more minor issues of sexual harassment or impropriety, and I think it is a case-by-case basis. And I don't think you want to go to an unreasonable extreme, because when you do that, I think you have a backlash. And I think that sometimes you get a counterproductive type of result.
I agree with that. You know, one of my concerns, though, is, you know, I do think women, speaking for myself, are a little fed up of not being believed, of not being listened to. I think 2016 was peak mansplaining year. You know, if one more man on Twitter explained to me how criminal law works, you know, thank you. I'm a criminal lawyer. And I think at this point there is this, you know, we want to be heard. We want to be believed. And, you know, quite frankly, yes, even minor allegations, maybe they shouldn't get you fired, but it isn't about sex. It's about control. And as long as men are in control in the workplace, women just have to put up with these, you know, even Mike Pence saying, I don't eat alone with a woman. Well, you know, as a woman in business, it's impossible to advance if you can't have a lunch with a partner in your law firm, with your boss who's a man. And the lesson from this shouldn't be, see, if you're alone with a woman, your penis will be exposed and then you'll be in trouble for sexual harassment. Those things don't naturally flow. And we have to change the culture. That has to start now.
It seems the culture is changing, because for the first time, and certainly in my lifetime, women are being believed when they present these credible and well-sourced allegations of harassment and sexual assault.
Some women, you know, women in Alabama who say that Roy Moore would troll the mall looking for 14-year-old girls, you know, stood outside of hearings in family law court where he knew little girls would be in custody battles, was banned, you know, from going to the mall because he was, you know, hitting on teenagers. If he gets elected to the United States Senate Then we're going to have to figure out whether women are being or girls are even being believed.
You know, there's a big difference between the way the private sector is handling this, Tad. Businesses are getting right in front of this, and the corporate culture is changing. In politics, a completely different story, because politicians are accountable only to the voters, and people see things through their partisan lens, and so. Whether it's a Democrat or a Republican who's accused, if the voters don't think it's important, that person can still get elected, reelected. They don't face the same level of consequences.
Yeah, well, perhaps so. There's a lot of, I think one thing that people need to understand about the law on sexual harassment, it's not easy. It's not something that you can automatically say somebody treated me or made some comment and therefore you're going to get a lot of money or you're going to win a lawsuit. There's a long process you got to go through. You've got to complain to the company. You've got to give the company an opportunity to resolve things. And then only then can you pursue a legal claim. And then you have to file a charge of discrimination. You have to go through the administrative process. Then in federal court, at least, there has to be a determination that the harassment was severe or pervasive. And that's a pretty high standard that the courts have said, listen, not every comment or not every, you know, stray look or stray remark is going to support sexual harassment. And then you've also got to determine, you know, whether the employer's response was significant or sufficient, that type of thing. So it's not as if we've got a ton of lawsuits going on to address sexual harassment in the private sector or public sector.
In a 1986 decision, the Supreme Court said the behavior needs to be severe or pervasive to qualify as harassment. And judges' interpretations of what qualifies as severe and pervasive can vary.
Oh, yeah. And in the federal courts, the judges really get to make a decision before the jury does. So they throw out a lot of these cases based on sort of a subjective view that this just wasn't enough. I mean, there was some cases in which some of the judges would say, well, listen, three or four gropes is just not enough to constitute sexual
harassment.
How many
gropes count?
Right.
Does it count?
Right.
Yeah.
And a lot of lawyers don't take the cases because of that.
Because I don't think they'll get a conviction.
Absolutely. Right. Or money. There's not a payday.
Right.
Well, lots of calls for attorneys Janet Johnson and Ted Delegal. What are your thoughts about more famous men losing their jobs over this? Matt Lauer and Garrison Keillor both let go yesterday. It's 549-2937. Hal is in Riverside. Hey, Hal, good morning to you. Hey, Hal, go ahead. All right, Hal, give us a call back. 549-2937. Herman up at JIA is on the line. Hello, Herman.
Good morning, gang. How is everyone?
Doing well, thanks.
Good. Just got two quick questions, one on task and one off. Question number one is, after an individual has retired, can they go back and sue their employer for discrimination acts, and is there a statute of limitation? And lastly, is this a gender game? And what I mean by that, is this only aimed at men who are behaving, irresponsible in the workforce? Do women, I guess, who ascend to that stature of power and authority, do they also sexually harass? And if a man was to come forward, would he be believed?
Okay, thanks, Herman, for those questions.
Okay.
Thanks for those.
We were actually, Tad and I were talking about that because, you know, my theory is it's about power. It's not about sex. You know, people say, well, men are just more sexualized and that's why this happens. But it really is people in power do things. I think Bill Clinton said in the 90s, I did it for the worst reason because I could. And women generally can't.
Yeah. But women in power positions can harass too.
Yes. Sure. And it is the same cause of action. Obviously, a man, you know, whether he'd be believed or not, I think he would be, and I think it would be the same lawsuit, personally.
Yeah. And what about his other question, Herman's other question, Tad? Can you file something years after the fact?
No, there's actually a pretty tight statute of limitations. You have to, in Florida, you have to bring a federal claim within 300 days or a state claim within 365 days. And the other thing is, with regard, he asked about retirement. It depends. Depends on the circumstance. Depends on what kind of discrimination you're talking
about.
But
by and large, if you're going to do something, you have to do it in a timely manner.
Right.
Okay. I hope that answers your question, Herman. Savannah is in Jacksonville. Hello, Savannah.
Hello.
Hey, go ahead.
So I don't really, it's not really a question, more so, you know, as someone who has dealt with sexual harassment in the workplace, and I've also, with being a leader in a corporate environment, having to take these sexual harassment courses and whatnot, I mean, I feel like a course is not going to fix the problem. It doesn't, you know, sure, it educates, but if you're an adult and you are in the workforce and you are capable of doing a job that you are given, you should also know that it is not something that you should do. You should not, you know, if you are unable to, you know, take the cues from another person, you know, man or woman, that you are making them uncomfortable with your sexual advances or, you know, comments and whatnot, like, that is on you. And I really feel like, you know, you need to do something more, needs to be done, not just these courses, because, you know, most people, if you step through those courses, you see, like, you know, people are just sitting around, they're bored, they're not really paying attention because it's like, oh, well, I already know this stuff. Mm-hmm. You know, but I feel like this is something that we need to talk with, you know, our friends and our family members and even our children and teach boundaries. And, you know, I feel like that's where it should start. If you're having a problem in the workplace, if you are not mature enough to know that, you know, what you are doing is wrong, then maybe you shouldn't be there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thanks, Savannah. I appreciate that call. It's what you were also referring to, Janet, when you said we need really a cultural change, a wholesale change in our culture so that everyone gets the message that this behavior is simply going to result in very negative repercussions for you if you are stupid right. enough to do it.
Right. Yeah. And again, I don't, you know, it's, I don't think it's like control. I don't think it's really even stupidity. I think it is, you know, control of your behavior. I think it is, like you said, this, you know, the powerful are always going to abuse the people without power. And, you know,
unless they know that they will face reprisals.
Or unless the power is evenly distributed between men and women so that the culture is more of, you know, cooperation, tolerance, and not, you know, just abuse.
Tad.
Yeah, I think that we are learning as a society how to treat each other. I mean, it was not that long ago that women really were not much a part of the workforce. And if you look at the history of sexual harassment, it's only been since the 80s that it's really been prohibited. So we are changing over time. I think people are learning more and more. Hopefully new generations are being more aware of these things. But it is a learning process, and I think the culture has a lot to do with it. You turn on the TV, you see images, you see objectification of women. You see treating people as objects, not as persons. And those things are wrong, and eventually, you know, hopefully we're going to resolve those things.
Well, yeah, although, I mean, you know, I'm getting an email from someone I know who's saying, I'm listening to you right now, and it's happened to me, and I didn't speak up. And I feel like it's not going to be resolved. We have given it time. I've been working for 24 years. It hasn't gotten better. You know, I think we're fed up with time. And that's part of what happened in 2016 is, you know, whether you liked Hillary Clinton or not, we have had 44 male presidents. We haven't seen one woman, one person who looks like us. That is systemic. It starts at the top, and it has gone throughout our culture to say women are fine in the workplace, but not in positions of power. We're not okay with that. In 2016, the message was received loud and clear.
Let's go to Monique in St. Mary's, Georgia now. Hi, Monique. Good morning to you. Thanks for holding. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. Excuse me. I was wondering if this is relative to a college setting. I know you're talking about sexual harassment in the workplace, but I was a single mother, and I went back to college 2 years ago, actually three, and had a professor that behaved very inappropriately. Many other students had brought it to the college's attention. Nothing was done. And it was a debacle. It took everything to get this man held accountable for his actions. Excuse me, I live in a small town, so it was embarrassing for my children.
Was he finally held accountable? What finally happened, Monique?
They eventually had an investigation, which was terrible timing because I had a daughter in college in grad school at the time, so I was not available for her. And when they started the investigation, they didn't ask for my permission. They just brought it up. So I had to still go to school with this professor there. And I could, if female students would ask him for help, he would say, just come to my office, mm-hmm. and expect us to go alone with him. Or mm-hmm. if we'd ask for help, he'd go, why don't you come scuba diving with me? Just very inappropriate things. And other people had written letters, other students. Finally, they did let him go. But what is frustrating for me watching this 2 years later is this does hurt families. This hurts women. And since then, I've proven myself. I've transferred to another school. I have graduated with honors with my associate's. I'm in a bachelor's program now. But it wasn't without a lot of hard work and loss. And it affected my family.
Yeah.
Wow. So my concern is that other people listening to these stories, that they're going to become complacent because it's becoming very common on the news right now, but it really does happen.
Yeah. Thank you for sharing your story, Monique, and I'm sorry that happened to you. And she points out the fact, Tad, that this is a problem across all types of workplaces,
sure.
including college campuses,
yeah.
any kind of workplace. You're a labor employment attorney.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter what kind of workplace it is.
No, and I will say that there has been a greater emphasis in higher education recently, enforcing Title IX standards, mm-hmm. which is the statute that applies to gender discrimination in education. So a lot of colleges have really been aggressive in trying to make sure that sexual harassment doesn't happen with professors.
Although, Melissa, you and I talked a lot about Jameis Winston when all of that was happening. And so we've seen that Title IX, while it's an effective tool, there are interests that trump Title IX, and campuses will protect their own. And, you know, if you see the star quarterback accused of rape and it's basically, you know, brushed aside, what are the odds that you complaining about your professor, that anything's going to get done? And that's why women give up.
Yeah. Yeah. And another thing, too, about Monique's call that she pointed out is that this problem ruins careers. Mm-hmm. So many women have lost their and men who've been harassed, right. but mainly it's women, have lost their careers. Their careers have been destroyed or cut short because they've been forced out,
right.
they've been fired, or they, in some way or other, the abuser has kept their position and the woman has been forced to leave.
Well, right.
What's different about the last few months is, for the first time, when women now finally feel as though they will be listened to if they bring the allegations forward, and the abusers are being held accountable rather than the
right.
accuser being professionally punished.
For now, I mean, you know, during the Weinstein revelations, a lot of women, you know, said, I just removed myself. I didn't complain. I didn't get fired, but I just decided I'm not going to pursue this anymore in terms of my career. Because it's just it's soul, you know, deadening. It just kills your desire to compete, or your desire, you know, to be on that stage. And I saw people tweeting as people were getting fired, wow, look at all the talent that's getting drained because these men are getting fired. Well, look at all the women who probably took themselves out of the workplace because they didn't want to deal with that every day.
Lots of social media questions. Here's one on our Facebook page for both of you, and it's from Josh. Please explain what the employer's responsibility is when someone comes forward.
Yeah, well, the employer needs to do a fair investigation and needs to try to take remedial action to try to prevent the harassment from continuing. That can mean firing somebody. It can be moving somebody else out, suspending somebody. It just depends on the situation. I think it's also important to note, I know that sexual harassment is very serious, and we need to make sure that harassed people are heard and they get the opportunity to explain themselves. But it's also important for the employer to do a fair investigation because, you know, there can be bogus claims made, and people need to be protected against that. And I think there are times when the employer can be held. If the employer is only believing women and not believing men in a one-on-one situation, the employer could be subject to gender discrimination claims by the men. if they're not being fair and relying on evidence. And so that's important.
All right. Let's go to Mogi. Mogi on the South Side. Hi, Mogi. Thanks for holding. Go ahead. All right. We lost that call. Lots of people have been waiting a long time. Mike on the West Side. Hello, Mike. Good morning to you.
Hey, good morning, and thank you for this conversation.
Sure.
Yeah, I was calling because I work for a very large transportation company in town and recently learned that in our management changeover, a manager was brought in who was fired from a previous company for sexual harassment and subsequently convicted of public indecency related to that incident. What is the employer's responsibility or liability in that case when they hire somebody who has a history of this behavior?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you for that.
I don't think there's a separate the separate liability would be for negligent retention or negligent hiring, which is another claim. If somebody is sexually harassed, suffers from this, then the employer could be liable for negligent retention or negligent hiring. It's hard to know what standards are used by other employers. Certainly, if the guy was criminally prosecuted, that's a big red flag.
And one more question for you both, and then we'll wrap this up. Often, in the past, women who have gone to their employers about a serial harasser have been asked to sign non-disclosure agreements, right, where they've accepted some sort of financial settlement and sent on their merry way and basically been given a gag order and told you can never discuss this. What that in effect has done has allowed the predator or the abuser to keep acting with impunity because everything has been secret. And so what about this movement to end or reduce the practice of corporate NDAs?
Right. Well, I know that was part of the Bill O'Reilly, those settlements, was that, you know, and again with Harvey Weinstein, they were all subjected to that.
They all had to sign those agreements.
It's awkward as a lawyer, I'm sure Tad will agree, because sometimes those are necessary, you know, they're part of the law and they're going to always exist. But whether there should be an exception for this kind of, you know, if it's criminal and not just civil, because I think that is what happened. I think there are many cases here where these are crimes. But, quite frankly, I think that's part of the Trump, why these 16 women, you know, have been sort of not believed and why there aren't more, because I think they did sign NDAs. And it's going to make it hard to know what's going on in a given workplace.
Yeah, I think generally, even if there are non-disclosure agreements, there's going to be evidence that could be brought up. You can get that information in a lawsuit where somebody has previously been accused of sexual harassment. Mm-hmm. It's not going to prevent you from getting that in a lawsuit, in a legal proceeding. So I have concerns about trying to limit settlements. I think a lot of time it's beneficial to the victims of sexual harassment to have confidentiality. These are not things that people want to have public. They bring these things up. Most of the women who've been harassed are very much scarred. And part of their healing may be to resolve things, but to move on, get another job, or move into another section of the company. But to be able to do it without thinking that they're going to be harassed in the future or blamed for bringing forward a claim. So I think there is a purpose for having confidentiality agreements.
But maybe use it as, not a sword or a shield. You know, let the victim or the person who was the complainant decide if they want to waive that. And if they do and want to come forward, there's a value in that as well.
And you have a court case, so I know you're
going to.
Thank you, Janet
Johnson.
You. As Janet heads to court, quick follow-up for you, Tad Delegal. You have a case that you're working on settling, don't you, that relates to this issue here in Jacksonville?
We've resolved it. It has to be approved by the city council. But it was a woman who was working in the jail. And she was a physician's assistant, and she was severely harassed by a supervisor. And one of the things that brings out is these are not easy cases to litigate. This took many hundreds of hours of attorney time. The fees on this were hundreds of thousands of dollars to get this done. And they can be quite difficult.
Keel is on the West Side. Keel, good morning. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, good. Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. Me and my wife have been discussing this for a while as well, and we've been seeing these things with Harvey Weinstein and everybody else coming out. And we feel that surely the conversation should be about objectifying women, which is what's been going on in Hollywood for years, in marketing, billboards, and everything else. So therefore, surely the culture has to change. But people have to understand that women are not objects. And therefore, even last night when we were watching some program, and you see how the women are treated in any of these characters, surely the problem should be that people should think that, no, women have to be treated equally in every sense of the word. And so therefore, I think the bigger problem is the objectifying of the women as opposed to, you know, going after once the problem has occurred. Thank you.
Thank you for that, Keel.
I agree with him 100%. I think that's the root problem is we go to the workplace and we treat people of you know, women differently as being objects rather than persons you work with. And frankly, you know, I think this is a generational thing. I think older generations have to be taught to work differently. I think the younger folks hopefully are learning better in the schools and that type of thing. But I think we're getting to a better point, and I think this recent trend is helping us.
Let's take one more call. It's Jamie on the West Side. Hey, Jamie. Good morning.
Good morning. Hi. I was just calling. I heard the lady before mentioned that, you know, Hillary Clinton, you know, she was a woman, so it was her time to be president. I was a Trump supporter. I voted for him, even though, truthfully, I dislike him immensely. But I will say this. Just because I'm a woman doesn't mean I have to vote for Hillary. And I have four daughters. I'm teaching them that if a man ever touches them, exposes himself, whatever it is, they are to scream, hit him, fight him. You don't stand there and take it. And I feel like women now, they believe that when men can do anything and they don't have to respond. You absolutely can respond and you should respond. If a man exposed himself in front of me, he's not going to leave the room the way he walked in. So that's my only comment.
All right, Jamie. Thanks for that. Lots of calls. And it's certainly the conversation the nation is having as well. So Tad Delegal, labor and employment attorney and a regular legal contributor to this show, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks, Melissa.
And we were also joined by local criminal defense attorney Janet Johnson on this segment. And much more still ahead. Later, our travel expert Judy Wells going roaming today as we head up the road to Georgia to see a special historic site. But up next, a closer look at National Runaway Prevention Month. We'll be right back.
Hendricks Avenue Baptist Church is a place to experience Christ's presence and God's Spirit in a vibrant faith community. HAB celebrates diversity, seeks to bridge differences, and journeys together in an honest and authentic search for truth. HABchurch.com. Find a different way of being Baptist.
WJCT and Vistar Credit Union are honoring the memory of Fred Rogers with the 15th annual Mr. Rogers Sweater Drive. The drive runs through November 30th and accepts new and gently used sweaters, jackets, and blankets. Contributions may be dropped off at WJCT and all Vistar Credit Union branches, Two Men in a Truck, and the Tom Bush family of dealerships. For more information, log on to WJCT.org. Contributions will be donated to selected nonprofit facilities within the First Coast area.
A Prairie Home Companion with Chris Thiele will be heading to the Big Apple, New York City, and the Town Hall for a live broadcast with special guests Spoon, Cecile McLaurin-Salvat, and comedian Carmen Lynch, plus our band, the First Call Radio Players, and duets with Sarah Jarosz, a bit of humor from our acting company, and Chris will be writing a brand new song for the show. All this and more this weekend.
Saturday evenings at 6 on 89.9 WJCT.
I'm Christian McBride. Next time on Jazz Night in America, birthers, truthers, reptilians. Oh, my. Darcy James Argue takes on the history of conspiracy theories with his jazz suite, Real Enemies.
We are living in a very paranoid time. We are all susceptible to it.
Tune in on Jazz Night in America.
Saturday nights at 8 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, in October of 2002, President George W. Bush hosted the landmark White House Conference on Exploited and Runaway Children. Leaders from across the country got together to discuss issues and challenges related to the runaway and homeless youth crisis in this country. And they expanded Runaway Prevention Week into a month-long awareness campaign. It's happening right now. November is National Runaway Prevention Month. And nationwide, up to 3 million kids run away each year. Here on the First Coast, JSO says last year, 74% of the 3,000-plus missing persons calls they received involved young people between the ages of 13 and 17. This same age group also makes up the largest number of habitual runaways. Now, these are not bad kids. They're good kids in bad situations. So by supporting National Runaway Prevention Month, you're showing America's runaway and homeless youth that they are not alone. Kim Sertivan is president and CEO of Jacksonville's Youth Crisis Center, and they're working very hard on this issue. She joins us now. Hey, Kim. Good morning.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
So the vast majority of calls JSO gets about missing persons are runaway kids.
They are.
I didn't realize that.
Very sad. Yes.
And the kids run away for a lot of reasons, but what are some of the most common ones?
You know, it could be peer-related, where friends are just wanting to go out, and, you know, they're just different reasons. They could be fearful of bad grades and parents finding out about that. It could be drug-related. It could be exploitation. Trafficking is becoming a new topic that's happening where they're going out and they're meeting men. Or it could be boys that are meeting women for different exploitation activities. And so it's just a very scary time for these young folks that are out on these streets.
And so many of them do end up becoming exploited.
They do. They do. And, you know, for them that are out there, they're having to find ways to survive. And so with that, you know, they're putting themselves at risk. And with that, they're turning oftentimes to drugs. They're not in school. They're having unprotected sex. Things are occurring that are very unsafe for these young folks.
Now, back during the Bush years, they decided, all of the advocates working on this issue expanded this awareness campaign from a week to a month.
Yes.
It's a big problem. It requires a whole month of awareness.
It is. And I think that they're trying to have more folks become aware that when you see a young person that's out on the street, what do you do with that young person? And there's actually a law now that says that if you have a person that shows up at your door, you cannot just have that person stay there without notifying their family members or notifying law enforcement. It's called harboring a runaway. And so there's measures that you need to take, whether you contact your local emergency shelter, such as Youth Crisis Center, and let them know, hey, we have this young person that has shown up. We want to help. Or you contact your local Department of Children and Families, or you contact law enforcement. But to just allow that person to couch surf, if you will, is harboring a runaway, and it is illegal.
Interesting. And people might not realize that.
Right.
That's such an important point. There is a positive return on investment in preventing runaways. You're saving on a lot of social service costs, law enforcement costs down the line if you can stop this cycle early in a young person's life.
Right.
Right.
And it's a matter of really just taking the time as a parent, as a caregiver, to build that relationship. Start early on. You know, don't find yourself so busy that you're not continuing to have that relationship. And so the best way is just to sit down, talk with your child, continue to have that mutual respect and relationship, unconditional love. And so that you just spend time letting them know that you're there for them. If you do start to find signs and symptoms that they're not connected with the family, let them know that you're there when they're ready to talk. Find out from their teachers or from their friends, are you noticing something that has changed with them and that you're wanting to try to help? Don't assume how they're feeling. The worst that you can say is you seem to be, because you may say something that is a trigger for that child, but you just want to know how are they feeling and that you're there for when they're ready to talk.
What are some signs parents and caregivers need to be aware of that their kid might be about to run off.
If you start to notice some changes in their behavior, if you start to notice some changes in their friendship circle, if they're not associating with people that they once did, if they're starting to associate with maybe older friends, they're not engaged in family activities that they once were, sleep patterns have changed. If you notice anything in their room that might have been packed up or looks different, changes just in overall grades, or their mood might be different, you might really want to take a look at that and talk with them about something that has changed.
So in short, just be really aware and tune into what's going on with the child in your life, the
Absolutely.
Young person in your life.
Pay attention.
Pay attention to the little things.
Right.
Can you tell us a little bit about how Youth Crisis Center operates to help this group of young people?
So Youth Crisis Center, we have a crisis hotline that is open 24/7. And so as you are questioning, is this something that I might be really needing to pay attention or something that may be going on, just give us a call and we can walk you through what type of program might be effective for your child. And we might be able to say, is there something that's happening at school that you want to talk with your teacher about? Is there counseling services that might be effective for your child that we can help, you know, improve their behavior or improve the family relationship? Is it a crisis that maybe they need to come and stay in our short-term residential program so that we can try to rebuild that family relationship? But it gives that child a separate time outside of the family so that they can talk independently without the parents there to build the relationship and to talk about how things are going on and how that they can get back home and you know, move forward with what's happening in their life.
That's always your goal, to reunite the family if possible.
Absolutely. That is our goal. And, you know, we don't want them on the streets. We want them to be in a safe space.
And that age group between 13 to 17.
It's very critical.
It's critical time. Adolescence is a tornado.
Right.
And kids have a lot of emotional and physical and hormonal changes they're going through, and they can act out in so many ways
right.
as they go through that.
Right.
And it's those teen years.
It's their time of forming their identity. Who am I? And so they do, you know, it is normative for them to start changing from being so critical and so, you know, with their family so much and developing who they are. But you don't want to lose sight of who they are. And you want to know who are their friends. You want to stay abreast of who are they with, but also give them some independence to make those decisions as well.
Now, in keeping with National Runaway Prevention Month, Youth Crisis Center just had a big event.
We did.
How did that go?
It went really well. YCC has rebranded, and so our focus now, instead of looking so much at serving at-risk youth, has really been impacting those that have been affected by traumatic life experiences, such as running away, which may have been caused by grief or loss or abuse or divorces, changing in relocation of homes. And so it's really just educating those that there are things in life that happen and that's okay, and that we're here to help those folks that, you know, to get back on track.
And people can get in touch with you anytime.
They can. They can contact us at our local number, 904-725-6662, our website, ycc.org.
That's easy to remember.
It absolutely is.
It's Youth Crisis Center, ycc.org. If you have a young person that you think needs help, get in touch with them, because it is National Runaway Prevention Month. But of course, they're helping all months of the year.
Yes.
Well, it's such a pleasure always to see you. And thank you so much for being with us.
Good to see you as well. Thank you.
She's Kim Sertivan, President and CEO of Jacksonville's Youth Crisis Center. Again, that website is ycc.org. A quick break, and then we're going roaming with one of our favorite people, travel expert Judy Wells. Find out where she's been going right after this.
Hendricks Avenue Baptist Church is a place to experience Christ's presence and God's Spirit in a vibrant faith community. HAB celebrates diversity, seeks to bridge differences, and journeys together in an honest and authentic search for truth. HABchurch.com. Find a different way of being Baptist.
When sexual harassment accusations bring down someone you admire, how do you deal with the shock? Many Americans were stunned to learn that NBC News fired Matt Lauer.
How do you reconcile your love for someone with the revelation that they have behaved badly?
It's a moment of national reckoning on harassment. How are you processing this? Next time on 1A. Weekdays at 10 after First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
on the next Fresh Air. Are we at a turning point in how we handle allegations of sexual harassment? We'll also look back on how Anita Hill's allegations against Clarence Thomas were handled in his confirmation hearings. We'll hear from New Yorker staff writer Jane Mayer, who wrote a book about the hearings, and Rebecca Traister, who writes about feminist issues. Join us weekdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
Congressman Keith Ellison has a prescription for the Democratic Party.
Re-engagement on a massive scale, and we are fighting for a program that's going to make their lives better.
The future of the Democratic Party, the DNC deputy chair says Dems need the ground game that Republicans won in 2016. That's next time on The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International.
Weekdays at 2 on 89.9 WJCT.
I'm David Luckin, host of the Electro Lounge, inviting you to join me Tuesday nights at 9 for Turntable Tuesday, only at the Electro Lounge on 89.9. Your community, your world, your music.
Welcome back. Well, it's an internationally renowned art site just up the road in Georgia that's been listed on the National Register of Historic Places. Passequan is also the site of Judy Wells' latest travel adventure. She's back from her visit there and joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning.
So you went up to Passequan.
Went up to Passequan. I had heard about it for years. I knew it had been restored by the Kohler Foundation, and I wanted to see what it was like. And you drive into this through this little, I mean, no stoplight, small.
Tiny little town.
And you go on these, you know, windy roads, and it's the last place you'd expect to find an art installation of any kind, much less this. But then Eddie Owens Martin, who was born at midnight on July 4th, 1908 in West Central Georgia to sharecroppers, is the last person you would expect to have done it.
He created it.
He created it.
Wow.
Now, Eddie never felt like he belonged. He hated farming, didn't get along with his father. And so at 14, he left home and wound up in New York's Greenwich Village at the height of the Roaring Twenties.
Oh, wow.
Now, his career included stints as male prostitute, street hustler, drag queen, tattoo contessa was his stage name. He was ahead of his time. He had tattoo arm sleeves. And a fortune teller,
back in
gambler,
the 20s.
Yeah, back in the 20s.
Wow.
Fortune teller, gambler, and cook for Southerners up north. When his father died, Eddie returned home and helped the family get in the crops. In 1935, he had a very bad ill spell. And the Passequans first came to him. Passequoyans, rather. And a dream.
Who were the Passequoyans?
They were the residents of a future world, future community that was all peaceful. All religions got together. Everybody was accepted. And you can imagine this was someone who'd never fit in.
So this was his vision of utopia.
And these people came to him. And he painted pictures of them. And everything was harmonious. And he changed his name to St. Om, E-O-M, all in capital letters, and took it upon himself.
He was a humble man.
He began to study other civilizations and their artwork and religious symbols. And so when the Passequans came to him again, he had several visions from them, dreams from them, and told him he needed to change his ways and build something out of his life. He took them literally.
So
he went back to the Georgia farm and began transforming it into a sanctuary for himself and any Passequans who might happen to visit.
And I'm looking at the website and your website, some amazing pictures.
Amazing pictures. Now, he was accepted in the community because he hired people to help him build this. He was not a builder. He was a self-taught artist. But the visions and the inspiration were all his. And as the word he coined, vibrations, they're overwhelming. When you get there, you don't know where to look first. The colors, the forms, the patterns, the figures, and visions are dizzying. Your senses are assaulted. And in trying to describe it, I keep returning to St. Om's vibrations, or Mr. Eddie, as they called him in town. He supported himself in his art environment, making and selling furniture and jewelry and telling fortunes that, by all reports, were remarkably accurate. People came to him from all around. He dressed as a shaman in colorful flowing robes and shell-covered hats, tinkling bells, and he must have been a real vision in this rural community.
And you have some pictures of him dressed in his shaman garb on your website. It's wellsworld.net. And people can learn more about Passequan on your website. If people want to make the trip, what is it, a few hours up the road?
A couple of hours up the road. It's about 3 hours, I think. It's between Americus and Columbus.
But it's well worth the drive.
It's well worth it. I would caution parents not to bring young children because the figures painted are anatomically correct.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Now, unless they want to get into those discussions,
yes,
then that's fine.
And also,
I also recommend the fried chicken at Annie D's, which is just off this little square.
Oh, very nice.
Everybody eats there, and it's wonderful.
We're almost out of time, but on your website, you have a few silent auction items for travel, too.
The Society of American Travel Writers, the auction is open again. They have wonderful things. Bidding ends at 11:55 p.m. Central Standard Time, December the 4th. And I advise you to read the fine print listings and exclusions before any items, before bidding on anything. And South African Airways Vacations. Can you imagine a 9-night trip into Cape Town, a safari with breakfast and meals and in-country flights for $4,199 per person, including international airfare?
I know Judy Wells can imagine it.
I found it.
Because it's on her website, and of course, she found it. If you want to grab some of these deals, and if you want to learn more about Judy's latest adventure to Passequan up in Lake Buena Vista, Georgia, go to her website. It's wellsworld.net. I love hanging out in Judy's world.
I wish you'd come sometimes.
I know. I want to come on some of these trips. Thanks for being here.
Oh, my pleasure.
And that's our show. Thanks for listening. Our producer is Kevin Mershart. Michelle Corum runs the board. The show theme is composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony's Pyotr Chevchik. 1A is up next. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT FM Jacksonville. Your community, your world. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow with our Friday Media Roundtable. See you then.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.